Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us today. Today it's my privilege to be interviewing John Burns. John Burns is a real estate consultant. He owns a business in Orange County. It's been in business since 2001. Has a BA in economics from Stanford and an MBA from UCLA. John, we welcome you to our show.
Thanks, Bruce.
Just to clarify some terms, what is the difference between a builder and a developer?
The way I look at it is a builder is somebody who does vertical construction and sells you a home, and a developer is somebody who plans the land and develops it to get ready for the builder.
Are nearly all builders developers now?
Oh, no, not at all.
Not at all, okay.
There are a lot of builders that do nothing but just buy finished lots from land developers.
Okay, so they still are pretty exclusive in their expertise.
A lot of them are, sure.
Okay.
So you look at some of the big public builders like an MDC, which is Richmond American Homes, and Beazer and Ryland. They do very, very little land development.
Okay. All right, well, who is your typical client, and what do they have you do?
My typical client, and you mentioned I've had my business since 2001. I should say I've been doing this since 89. My typical client is one of the largest home builders in town, either a publicly held home builder or a large private home builder. And we also work for their construction lenders and their equity sources, doing two things, really. We're on retainer to monitor the market conditions for them, just because there's so much information out there that's positive and negative. We help sift through that so they can have some confidence in the decisions they're making.
Okay.
And then we also do a lot of custom consulting projects, either helping them expand into a new market or looking at a particular project that they're doing and helping them target the right demographics and price it and those sorts of things.
So you do this on a national basis?
Yeah, we do it all over the country, but I'd say 50% of our business is in California.
Okay. Over the past 20 years, what have been some of the significant changes that have occurred in the building business?
Oh, there's been a lot. The home building business, it was very, very unsophisticated 20 years ago, and some people even say it's got a lot of sophistication to go. If you look at the 1980s, a lot of the largest home builders were privately held companies. Today, they're publicly traded. They may have been doing no more than 1,000 homes a year tops, and now some of them are doing more than 40 or 50,000 homes a year. They're much more geographically diversified. KB Home, for an example, was pretty much a California builder. Now they're one of the largest builders in Florida and Texas. So those have been some of the changes.
Okay.
I think technology has changed them quite a bit, too. They were very entrepreneurial, small little companies, almost like running a whole bunch of little communities out at the job site, and now they're more centralized and know what's going on all over the country.
Okay, then do public companies make decisions differently than private companies would?
I believe so. Public companies have a quarterly report card they have to make to Wall Street, and their currency is their stock price. So they constantly have their eye on their stock price, and what Wall Street thinks about them as a company is reflected directly in their stock price. The private builders can think more long-term than that.
Okay. Now, when you say their stock price is their currency, does that directly reflect on their access to capital?
It does. And, for example, if they wanted to buy a private builder, they might use some of their stock to do that. If they wanted to make an acquisition, or even some of them would be concerned about being acquired if their stock becomes too cheap, they pay a lot of attention to it for those reasons.
Okay. As a consultant, do you have access to the right decision makers in a timely manner since they've gotten so big?
That's a broad question. There are a lot of decision makers in the companies. So I have relationships with most of the CEOs. In California, my relationships would be more with the division president folks, and a lot of the decisions are sent down to the division president guys with some sort of final approval at corporate.
Okay. Do the decision makers at the top feel outside pressure to keep production numbers up then? Is that something that sometimes dictates what they do?
I think that's a tough question, because I think some of them would say yes, some of them would say no. They really have a lot of outside pressure to have good financial metrics, which would be return on equity and return on capital. And clearly, if you're growing in size, that's easier to do than if you're shrinking in size or remaining flat. So I would say the answer to that would be yes, although in a cyclical downturn like we're in right now, Wall Street may respond more favorably to them saying we're going to cut our unit count 15 to 20% this year versus trying to grow it in a down market.
Okay. I noticed that April 27th, you're speaking at a BIA conference, and its title is Annual Development Trends and Strategies, and then subtitle, What a Difference a Year Makes. Last year's topic was urban infill lots, which I would presume that they thought that was the most important topic for 2006. And as you know, that probably would drive me a little crazy. So why wouldn't a strategy conference in 2006 tell in advance what was in store for builders in the next year? That's a tough question, too, I know.
No, I think it did. I mean, that event, it wasn't all just, go build high-rises, guys. It was a, there are a lot of problems with doing this, and there's a lot of risk, and you need a different organization structure and a different set of risk metrics and those sorts of things. But there was a long-term view that the coastal markets, such as Orange County, are becoming more urban, and heck, even with the detached homes in Orange County, you could argue they're pretty urban, too, because the lot sizes are so small.
Okay.
So that was the focus, more like, look, we're running out of land, we're becoming more urban, and if you're going to do this urban, particularly some of the mid-rise and high-rise, I mean, you really need to change your business model substantially to do that.
Okay. The part, what a difference a year makes, would you say that the industry, by and large, was caught off guard by what's occurred?
I would say nobody expected the correction to be as swift as it has been. I would say that most of my clients, although they don't really make a big deal out of this, have been planning for some sort of a correction for years. I mean, I've been speaking at one of my clients every quarter. Since 2004, they've been having a meeting called Preparing for the Downturn, and nobody knew when it was going to occur or what it was going to be like. But they've been planning for it. And let me give you some examples from some of the public guys. Everyone's planned for it a different way. Like I mentioned, a Ryland or a Richmond American or some of those folks planned for it by just never being long on land. Others, Lennar would be one of the leaders in this, have really been very sophisticated with their project financing, getting other people's money and structuring deals so they literally can change what they're paying for the lots mid-project. With the Irvine Company, it's rolling option takedown. So you only buy the land as you need it, and if the market changes, then you can go back to the Irvine Company and renegotiate price or just choose not to buy the land. So a lot of them have been preparing for this, but nobody knew for sure when it would occur and what it would be like.
What do you think has occurred that's put the downturn on fast forward? Why has it happened so quickly?
I think the affordability is probably the biggest problem, and we just got to a point where we had borrowed a lot of demand for the future. We sucked all the quality renters out of apartments and put them into homes, and nobody could afford the prices anymore. And then once, really what drove the speed of it, I believe, and it's been very swift in the new home market, in my opinion, has not been very swift at all in the resale market, is that these are very well capitalized, large companies who are volume oriented, and when they see sales slow, can drop prices very quickly to get some sales.
Okay. going back in time, 1989, the housing market was booming. And by 91, unsold homes went up by about 1,000% in a two-year period. What was different about that downturn and the one that we're currently experiencing?
Oh, the big difference is the economy.
Okay.
During that period, Los Angeles lost 431,000 jobs. Orange County lost jobs as well, so did San Diego. There's a complete destruction of the aerospace industry, the savings and loan industry. The savings and loan industry was the provider of construction capital to the business, too. So all the construction capital completely disappeared. What is very unique about this downturn is that we have job growth.
Job growth, almost historic low interest rates. So it was easy to get blindsided by something that no one could see coming?
Yes, because the rule of thumb has been housing downturns occur when economic downturns occur. And as I look at it now with some 2020 hindsight, we should have had a housing correction in 2002 because we had an economic downturn. The country was in a recession. Southern California lost jobs. But the Fed really got on top of that very, very early and dropped the Fed funds rate from 6.5% all the way down to 1%, essentially propping up the U.S. economy with the housing business. And so the housing business skated through that downturn as if there was not one because mortgage rates are falling so quickly. And we're having the downturn, if you will, that we should have had 4 or 5 years ago, but at affordability levels that are much worse than they were back then.
Absolutely. Well, do you see unemployment growing when we get into 2008? Do you think that's a possibility?
I'm not somebody who forecasts employment per se. I mean, I don't have models and those sorts of things. I read everybody else's projections and try to make sense of it. And I actually can't find an economist who's projecting job losses in Orange County. In fact, in Southern California. Interesting side note to that, I've been challenging the Chapman University folks for years who've been predicting a home price correction while job growth is occurring, and that never made sense to me. But now I'm starting to realize where they were coming from, that can actually happen. They just called it 2 years too early.
Well, I think when it all shakes out, I think we're going to look back again, that 2020 hindsight, is we've gotten to such a price compared to earnings ratio that the only way we can support the price is if we have a 6 or 6.5% interest rate. If we really ever end up with a more normal interest rate, I don't know how we'll support the monthly payment and sell the next house to the next buyer. That'll be a real hard thing to do.
Oh, I completely agree. Anyway, there's no room to be raising prices anymore.
No, and that's on a monthly basis, not just retail price, but the dollar per month is really maxed out for a while.
Right.
If a consultant had sat down with a builder in December 2005 and told them that the market by 2007 was going to be a mess, how would that information have been received?
It would have been, well, you did it.
You're right, I did it.
They poo-poo it. In fact, I spoke at a large industry conference last month, and told them that I thought it was going to be 2011 until we'd start to see some stability in the market. And, you know, I said that because there's no need to say even later, because by then you've got their attention.
Yes.
And almost everyone came up to me afterwards and say, oh, we agree with you that 2007 is going to be a bad year, but I'm sure 2008 will be fine. And when I ask why, and this included one CEO of one of the largest publics, I don't get any decent answer. I think this group is very much cut from the optimistic cloth. And if you wouldn't, I don't think you'd get into land development unless you were an optimist, or it doesn't seem like too many pessimists get into the business. And they run their business that way. Despite, you know, me mentioning that they plan for the downturn and they think about those things, that's really kind of the CFO in the organization that is responsible for all that.
Mm-hmm.
But the CEOs and the land acquisition people and those and the sales and marketing folks are all very optimistic people.
Well, now they've been walking away from hundreds of millions of dollars of option money on land.
Yep.
And they've got a record number of unsold homes. So at some point, you would think it would be in their best interest to go from optimist to realist. And the sooner the better.
I'm spending a lot of my time working on that.
And why do they, I know that they're inherently optimists, but why would they not want to know of a negative scenario that was accurate in advance? I'm having a hard time wrapping my arms around that one.
That's a great question. I struggle with that too.
Is it because the public persona and the stock and all that, does that have a lot more to do with it than if they were just a private company, do you think?
No, because I see the private, and I'm labeling the entire industry with one label here, which is not fair.
Okay.
But I would say the private companies are just as optimistic.
Okay.
But there are maybe a quarter of my clients that I think you would consider to be pretty realistic that have already shut divisions in certain markets that were very proactive at laying people off, that didn't buy much land over the last 2 years, and now their problem is, heck, I don't have any land to sell homes on next year. What am I going to do? You can't paint them all really with one broad brush like that.
Okay. Have contractors in California laid off quite a few workers since the end of 2005?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. Do you know if these workers typically stay in California and look for construction jobs in another, maybe in the commercial world, or do they sometimes leave the state and cause migration loss?
I think there's some of both. But interestingly, just like the people that I know who were let go, they've all landed jobs somewhere. And then the commercial business, as you mentioned, is booming, so maybe that's the next real estate bubble you'll be talking about, the commercial business.
I think it is, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
I think, doesn't it usually follow housing? If housing has a problem, that it does end up having an effect. I don't know if it's a direct correlation, but it just seems like that does occur, the commercial business.
Housing downturns have always been correlated with job losses, and job losses are definitely, impact the office market.
Correct.
And then, the consumer spending impacts the retail market, so when people's home prices are going down, their spending usually slows, so they're usually pretty highly correlated.
Okay. When did the builders first notice sales were declining?
There's been a couple hiccups over the last 3 or 4 years that got people nervous. But I think once it really started would maybe be July, August 2005, somewhere in there.
Okay, which is interesting because that's the exact month that the lowest ever affordability number was hit for a month again. So it literally coincided with that exactly, whether that's why or not. That's my theory, but
they would be coincided because that's when they stopped raising prices.
That's right. They had no place to hide the extra monthly dollar.
Right.
Okay.
But adjustable rates bottomed out in March of 2004. So I was surprised that it took another 15-16 months another 15-16 months of price appreciation occurred before the market slowed.
Do increased cancellations currently play a big part of declining closed sales for a builder? Are they going into escrow and then finding out that it's not really going to stick?
Oh yeah, they tell me stories all the time of people that are closing and just not showing up for closing.
They're just not showing up.
Just not even showing up for closing. Yeah.
And walking away from deposits, or do they get them?
No.
Back?
Well, in California, my understanding is it's pretty hard to keep somebody's deposit.
Yes, it is.
The builders have really not been collecting big ones for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
And, the buyer profile they had the last 2 or 3 years hasn't had one in the first place. So that's part of the issue.
We're going to cover that in the next segment.
Right.
Does a negative media affect people's willingness to walk away and not buy a new home?
I think it does. I think that excuse is very overblown. I mean, if you believe that negative media was impacting home sales, then home sales would have shut off in 2002, because that's when the whole housing bubble started, when Fortune and Barron's ran articles on it. And interestingly, I think the housing bubble articles had gotten so overblown by 2004 and were so stale, you actually saw the articles go away in 2005.
That's right. You're exactly right. And when, I guess when somebody came up and said something, when we start talking about not a bubble, but, you know, just that we're going to have a negative scenario, that yes, it had been said for 3 years. It was almost old news, but it was received like, oh, sure. But that's why. Do you think investor purchases created an almost no-risk environment for builders during that 2002 to 2005, those years?
What do you mean by a no-risk environment?
It seemed like they were willing to take anything that a builder was willing to sell them. So I don't know how a builder could have had an unsold new home.
That's true.
Okay.
Builders couldn't, they couldn't raise prices enough.
That's right. That's why investors bought them, because they usually made a lot of money. Matter of fact, they probably made more than the builder did on the original sale. So it became a flipper's heaven, if you will.
Right. That's true.
What percentage of new home sales do you think are to investors at this point?
In Southern California?
Yes.
That's a tough question, because I think there are some optimistic investors still out there who see a builder dropping price $100,000 and are buying the unit. And, just off the cuff, you'd say, well, I don't think there's many investors out there, yet I'm getting wind that there are, that people are, they're just, well, gee, 100 grand off, Southern California is a landlocked environment, I'll buy this, and, this is going to be a short-lived downturn. And those people are cut from the same cloth that the builder CEOs are, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, would we categorize them as speculators then, probably not investors? Because I don't think there's any way of the cash flow.
No, yeah, I would categorize them as speculators, yes.
Okay. Now, is California kind of one of the worst hit states for the downturn, or do we have an equal in Florida?
Well, the dynamics there are quite different. As I look at it, the heavy investing in California started in about 2001 in Sacramento, and I believe, just as you say, it stopped cash flowing a couple years after that. So I saw a lot of investors, and I don't network with them like you do, but just from what we see from our market research, getting out of California, moving into Las Vegas in 2003, 2004,
mm-hmm.
and then moving into Phoenix in 2004, 2005. Yeah. So that was kind of the West Coast investor activity.
Now, the Florida investment activity, did that come from that? I remember reading a study from the realtors that about 17% of their entire market was purchased by people from other than living in this country, so foreign investors.
Right. There are four direct flights a day from the UK into Orlando. I was advising one of my clients in Orlando, and I was at his offices one day. And that day, an investor realtor showed up from the UK with 58 checks from 58 different investors, sight unseen.
Okay.
And, it was because it was so easy to get to Orlando. Now, Orlando is a bit of a different market, because there is a strong ability, or there's a good ability, to rent out your condo for the week.
Okay.
So there are actually builders that over decades have been catering to those folks. But clearly it surged. And my understanding is there were some exchange rate issues involved with that too, where it looked expensive in the United States, but because the value of the dollar had changed, the price hadn't changed much, or maybe even gotten cheaper in some foreign countries.
Sure, the pound was worth a lot more, so somebody coming from England would think Florida was on sale, that's for sure.
Right, exactly. And then South Florida was really all from South America.
Okay.
Was a lot of it. And then there was a lot of New York Americans, kind of northern folks, coming down and buying homes almost sight unseen in Florida. So I think it was probably bigger in Florida because of the ability to buy condos.
That's correct. Well, John, we're running out of time for this segment. We want to thank you for joining us, and we'll continue this in the next segment.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week at 5:30 here on News Talk 590 KTIE.